Fly Fishing Internet Radio, your source for learning more about fly fishing in cold water, warm water, and salt water. Hello, I'm Roger Mays, your host for tonight's show. On this broadcast, we'll be featuring Jim Stenson, and he'll be answering your questions on The Tale of Three Fish. This show will be 90 minutes in length, and we're broadcasting live over the Internet. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use the Q&A text box to send us your question. We'll receive your question immediately, and we'll try to answer as many of them as possible on the show tonight. And while you're there, make sure you sign up to receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Just fill out the form on the right side of our homepage, and we'll let you know when the next live show will be. This broadcast is being recorded and will be available for playback on our website about 48 hours after the show ends. You can also find it on any of the podcast sites like Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. So if you have to leave early, you can return to our website or any of our podcast platforms at your convenience and listen to the recording at any time. If you're out and about on Facebook, Instagram, or X, we'd sure appreciate it if you'd share our podcast. And when you do, use the hashtag AskAboutFlyFishing and hashtag FlyFishing. In fact, if you have a moment, do it right now while you're listening to the show. That would be wonderful. The content of this broadcast is copyrighted and is the property of the Knowledge Group, Inc., doing business as Ask About Fly Fishing. When we return, we'll be talking with Jim Stenson about A Tale of Three Fish. Enrico Puglisi flies pride themselves with creating unique and one-of-a-kind flies and fly tying material. Enrico has been experimenting with durable synthetic and natural materials to create flies that catch fish for more than 30 years. His innovative products, including brushes, fibers, and components, have made a major impact on the direction of saltwater fly fishing, and his methods and materials are respected worldwide. Whether you want your flies hand-tied for you or you'd like to tie your own, make sure you visit Enrico Puglisi Flies and browse through their online catalog. Visit epflies.com and do a little shopping today. Again, that's epflies.com. Before we introduce Jim, we'd like to let you know about the great prizes we have to give away tonight. For our drawing tonight, we'll be giving away a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International and a one-year membership to Trout Unlimited. Now, if you haven't registered for the drawing, you can do it now. Just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and look for that link under Jim's section that says register for our free drawing. Click on that link, fill out the form, and we'll announce the winners at the end of the show. We'll also be giving away a copy of Jim's book, A Tale of Three Fish, courtesy of Stackful Books. Now, here's how you can win. You must be the first person to answer the question we ask at the end of the show. The question will be about something that Jim and I have talked about during the show, and you just submit your answer along with your name and location using that text box on the homepage. It's the same text box you can ask questions through during the show. So listen closely, take great notes, type fast, and maybe be the proud winner of Jim's book, A Tale of Three Fish. Our guest tonight is Jim Stenson. Jim attended Florida University and received a bachelor's degree in information science and a master's in library science and information studies. He has written numerous articles and columns about fly fishing, surfing, and the unique culture of South Florida. He was the managing editor and publisher of The Contemporary Sportsman and The Contemporary Wing Shooter magazines. He is the founder of Sweetwaters Adventure, an international adventure travel company catering to fly fishermen and wing shooters. He also owns Integrated Digital Publishing, an outdoor marketing company specializing in graphic design, photography, web design, and video development. Jim, welcome back to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio.
Oh, thanks. It's been a while, and I was going to get back here a couple months ago. This is great.
Yeah, 2 months ago, almost exactly, that I was in the hospital getting back surgery. So that's why we didn't do it.
2 months ago, yeah. I was up in the fishing for Atlantic salmon.
Yeah, we had to cancel because of a little back fusion going on. But we're here today, so carry on, right? Yeah, you just recently, this past year, released your newest book, right, A Tale of Three Fish, and published by Stackpole Books. And in it, you talk about the Holy Trinity, the permit, the steelhead, and Atlantic salmon. So, you know, what inspired you to write the book, A Tale of Three Fish?
Well, I think when I first started, I'd fished. I grew up in Fort Lauderdale, and I grew up fishing on the piers along the East Coast. And we caught a lot of big permit. I mean, we caught kingfish. Lake Worth Pier, there was probably 25 or 30 sailfish come over. There was 10 permit that were all considered IGFA world records that came off the pier. And so I sort of grew up fishing for permit. I mean, that's essentially what we chased. But after I got out of high school, I wanted to go catch steelhead. And I left Fort Lauderdale, I guess, God, I saw it so long ago. But I left Fort Lauderdale, loaded everything up in my Suburban, and I drove up to Portland, Oregon. And I always wanted to catch a steelhead. I'd read everything and everything possible about steelhead. I knew every fly to use. I knew every rod. I knew where to go, which rivers. And when I got up there, I was up there for about, I don't know, 2 or 3 days. I was staying in a place called one of the local hotels called the Shiloh. And it was right down the street from a place called Bill Olger Lincoln Mercury. And so I was looking for a job. I was only 17 years old. And so I was looking through Portland. I was trying to find a job, but I was going back and forth to Coffin's Steamborne Fly Fishing Store, which just happened to be one of the best fly fishing stores on the planet. But I kept going. I kept figuring if I just kept going down there over and over, day after day after day, somebody would give me a job. But there was just a long list of other people waiting to get a job, too. So that didn't work out. So I was running out of money, and I was running out of hotel fees, and I was downtown Portland, Oregon, and I was in a diner, and right across the street from the diner was a place called Church of Scientology. And about two blocks down, that's where the Hare Krishna people were out on the streets trying to get people to give money and all this stuff. And I sit down at the diner, and this guy comes up, and there's only one actually chair left, and goes, "Do you mind if I sit down?" And I said, "No." You know, what, I really didn't care. I didn't know who he was. And so we started talking, and come to find out, he owned Bill Olger and Lincoln Mercury in Beaverton, Oregon. And so we must have talked for like two and a half hours, and he was so amazed that somebody would drive all the way up from Florida to Oregon just to catch steelhead. And one thing led to another, and he offered me a job. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't have any dress clothes. I didn't have any shoes. I had shorts, flip-flops, and essentially that's the only thing I had. So he took me into the mall on the other side of the dealership. And the guy bought me 4 pairs of pants. He bought me 4 shirts, 3 or 4 jackets. He bought me new shoes. Then he turns around, gives me car keys to a demo, which at the time I think it was a Zephyr. It might have been something different. But anyway, then he goes and he gives me a car, and 2 blocks up the road, this new apartment complex just opened up. And so he tells me, go up there, give this to the owner, and if you have any problem, give me a call. Then come back tomorrow morning, and we'll start selling cars. I had no clue what happened. But one of the guys I met at the car dealership was a guy named John Nuttall. He was about 6'3", 6'4", 280, 290 pounds. He was a lineman for University of Arizona, and he got drafted by the Cincinnati Bengals. He blew his knee out, but he came back to Portland, and he went to work there. And lo and behold, he loved to fish. And, you know, we sort of talked back and forth and got to know each other. And he started taking me to all the rivers in Oregon, from all the way down from the Snake in California, all the way up to British Columbia. And, you know, it was just sort of a cool thing. And I had never caught a steelhead. I knew everything and everything in the world about a steelhead. But we get to the Clackamas River one day, and the water's really high, and we couldn't fish, and so we were going up and back and forth, up and down the river, trying to find a place that we could actually wade. So we never did. Then we went to another river called the Clackamas, and that was even closer to Portland. And I've always been leery about rivers that are really close to the cities because they're usually overfished and they're hard to get to. But the Clackamas was pretty empty. I pulled up in the Bronco, climbed out, and put on my waders and boots and stuff and walked down to the river, walked into the river. I'd never waded before. I mean, this is totally new. I lived in shorts and flip-flops. I really wasn't sure how to wade, and I really wasn't sure how to swing flies. And John, he was a conventional fisherman. He fished every Popsky's Green Label salmon eggs to cured salmon eggs to every spinner you could think of. And so while he's getting dressed, I walked down into the river, and I slipped and fell. And so I got up again, and I was looking out in the middle of the river. There's this huge boulder, and there was water pouring over one side and pouring over the other side. And I made a pretty good cast, and I had a couple flies that I got from Kaufman's. And the first fly swung down, and instead of going over the rock, it went down beside the rock, turned around and went into the water, the flush water underneath on the front side, and I hooked a steelhead, the first cast. And I fought the thing for probably, I don't know, maybe 5, 6, 7 minutes, and I finally got the thing up on the beach, and then I was sitting on my butt with my legs spread, and I was trying to take the hook out of this little 6-7 pound steelhead. But that was my first steelhead on a fly. But then it took me 2 years to catch another one, which is sort of disgusting.
Was that the first time you had been fishing for steelhead? Was the day you caught that?
I'd never been fishing. I never caught a steelhead. I'd never been fishing for steelhead. And I got that little 6-7 pound steelhead. It was a little buck. And John comes running down, and he's going to net the fish, but I already had the fish between my legs, and I was taking the hook out, and I released it. And so I thought this was going to be a pretty regular thing. So I spent 2 years. I spent 2 years chasing steelhead all over the place. And eventually, 2 years later, down on the Wilson River, down by, it was on the eastern side of the river, right next to the Trask. And I was sitting, there was a guide shack up top, on top of the road. It was about, I don't know, maybe a quarter mile up the canyon. And you could see it, but all the guides that worked out of the guide shack, there were rod builders, there were guides, there was all sorts of neat things in there. But there was a guy standing down about, I don't know, maybe 150 yards down. And we were walking our way down the Wilson, and I hooked this big steelhead. It took 2 years to get to the second one, and by the time I was slipping, falling, it was raining, it was cold, it was miserable, and this fish was going downstream. And I didn't think I could ever get it because he was going to school me. I couldn't walk because I was slipping on the rocks, I was climbing over logs, and so he came running up the river, and eventually he met me halfway and helped me land the fish, and it was a 16-pound steelhead. And so that was my second fish.
Yeah.
But since
from
then,
that first experience that you had fishing, did you learn anything from that about fishing from steelhead?
Well, fundamentally, it's swing and fly. Steelhead is easy. You know, it's not. I think it's more about reading the water and being able to, you know, to look out there and look at a river and sort of decide where you think the fish are going to be. Because they do. They actually sit these stations before they move up the river. And if the water's right, or they don't really like the fast water, everybody thinks they do, but they don't. They're always off to the side in the shallow water, and they really move up the sides of the river. They don't really come up the middle of the river. And the Wilson's not a big river anyway. I mean, it's a nice river, but it's not a huge river.
Mm-hmm.
But we started, I kept going back down there. And I got to know this guy really well. And I sort of left John behind in Portland. And this guy taught me just about anything I ever needed to know about catching steelhead. But going back to 9 or 10 years ago, I started running steelhead trips from Mobile, Alabama, running steelhead trips up to the lower rivers in southern Oregon. And from there, I went to British Columbia and found the Skeenan, the Maurice, the Buckley, all these great salmon rivers, I mean, steelhead rivers and salmon rivers. It was a phenomenal. And, you know, you just had to take it one step at a time. And you just sort of had to learn how to swing the flies. But the downside to, well, it's not really a downside, but, like, if you're going to swing a fly for an Atlantic salmon, you tend to have a really light tip and a light fly. You don't have much weight. But fishing, say, the Maurice in October, November, in that cold water, you know, you're using big spay rods, you're using heavy tips, heavy T20, and you're using heavy flies. And because you got to get the fly down in front of the fish, they don't tend to come up very well. But I've had such great trips to the up into British Columbia. But I started running right after that. I started running these trips in southern Oregon, and we started renting houses and bringing in guides, and I got to know the people at Sage A lot of the guys out there, they would come down and they would help guide. And we started swinging these smaller rivers south in southern Oregon, and we did really well. I mean, they're not bigger fish. They were 6, 7, 8, 9 pounds. It was a big fish. But it was still really nice. And when COVID came around, all of a sudden you couldn't fish. They closed down the beaches. They closed down the guides, the tackle shop, and all this stuff. And when it opened back up, it's never really been the same. There's still fish there. Don't get me wrong. The Wilson's still got fish on it. A lot of the rivers down south have got fish on them. But they're not what they were before COVID. And I'm not saying that COVID had anything to do with the fishermen. I'm just saying it was a coincidence, but everything sort of went to hell in a handbasket.
What did you, when you run these trips, you know, you're gathering people together, you're selling them on the trip. What expectations do you create for them? You know, hey, come on my trip. We'll go steelhead fishing. And
if it's a winter steelhead trip, I say, I bring mostly my friends on these winter steelhead trips. And we know from experience that catching winter steelhead under the best conditions is difficult. Once you get south, and like in southern Oregon, it gets even more difficult. But there are some really, really good rivers down there, but the problem is there's so many people fishing them. But we would rent these big houses that overlooks the coast. We'd bring in guides, but we love to eat Dungeness crab. So we spent, most of the week fishing in the mornings, fishing some in the afternoons, but mostly we were eating as much crab as we could find. And
okay.
But it's kind of a cool thing, but it was the whole trip. I want to say it was $29.50 for 7 nights, 6 days fishing, and that included the guides and the food. We essentially went out and ate because there's all these restaurants around these small towns.
Yeah.
And food's really good. But it just sort of grew. I mean, it's not one of these things. When you go to British Columbia, obviously you're going to spend 2, 3, 4 times the amount of money. And you expect to get bigger fish. You expect to get more fish.
Yeah.
I mean, there's times when the fish, I've tried to tell people about this before. When they go out to British Columbia, one, it's going to cost you a lot of money. You've got to fly out to Vancouver, then you've got to take another flight up to Smithers, and that's going to cost you. Then you get your license, then you got to go to the lodge. But each lodge is different, and they have different licenses and different watersheds. But all things considered, the Maurice River in October and November is one of the best steelhead rivers in the world. It's just, and I fished the Dean, the Babine, all these rivers. But just, the Maurice River is not only one of the most beautiful rivers on the planet, it's fast, it's cold, it's hard gravel. I mean, it's easy wading. And, depending upon what time of year it is and where the fish are, sometimes we move up and sometimes we move down depending upon when the fish have come in and when a lot of them will just stage. There's a big lake above Maurice Lake, and that's when they go up and spawn. It's not very much different than Atlantic salmon. But the good thing is that the steelhead are much more gullible to flies than Atlantic salmon.
Yeah. We need to take a quick break here, but when we come back, and you can think on this during the break here, is well, I'm going to ask you, what your most unique experience was for fishing for steelhead in your life. So think on that. We'll be right back. The Ugly Bug Fly Shop in Casper, Wyoming has been serving fly fishers in Wyoming and around the world since 1983. Their selection of top-of-the-line gear and a huge assortment of flies is one of the best in the land. All products are available in their fly shop and online. Looking for advice? Just give them a call and their expert professional staff will help you with whatever you need. Visit the Ugly Bug Fly Shop today at uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. Again, that's the uglybugflyshop.com or call them at 866-845-9284. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jim Stenson about A Tale of Three Fish. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. So, Jim, what has been your most unique experience fishing for steelhead?
Well, there's all the rivers, the mouth of the Skeena where all the rivers come in, there's fish everywhere, normally anyway. The problem with fishing for steelhead is they're an anadromous fish too, and you don't necessarily get the same fish every year. And there's fish that come in the spring, there's fish that come in the summer, there's fish that come in the fall, which is also this winter hatch, a big fish. Move up, and they move up to either the upper Skeena, the upper Buckley, or they move into the Maurice, where the Maurice dumps into the Buckley. And it's just a unique fishery. Last time I was up there, I fished with four guys, or three other guys most of the time, because I've known them for so long. And we can really give each other sort of a hard time. But the last time I went up there right before COVID, we were fishing, I think it was, let's say it was like third week in November, and it was raining and it was snowing and it was cold, and I've got pictures of the stuff you'd never believe. And so we had so much gear on, and we would run up in there with these jet sleds, and we'd get out and you'd drop people off at different parts of the river. We're still close enough to see each other, and so but still far enough away where none of us got into each other's face. But we went up there, and I had a friend, his name's Joe Hovius, but he always thought that I was taking his fish. It didn't matter where I was fishing, up or down, up the river. If I caught a fish and he didn't catch a fish, he would swear that I I went and scoped this fish out and took it away from him. But we were up there, and it was snowing, and it was probably 2.5 foot deep. The jet sleds were buried in snow, but we had to pull all the snow out and put our gear in there. And so we would run up the Murray's, and he would drop us out in various other places. And so Joe and another guy named Gary Whipple that always goes with us, he sits here and he goes, okay, where are you going to fish? And I'm going, no, you make up your mind, where are you going to fish? And I said, no. And so we went back and forth between the three of us, and I said, make up your mind. So they said, so Joe said, well, I'll fish down here, and Gary can fish by the boat. But the problem is I went up maybe, I don't know, maybe a half mile, three quarters of a mile up the river, and it dawned on me when I got there that there was I couldn't get around the corner because there was a bunch of timber falling, and the water was really deep. But so I was trying to fish across the river and started short, but I worked my way across and started swinging these flies down. But every time I just got this itch in the back of my neck that there had to be a bear. Okay, because there's Maurice River, there's more people been mauled on the Maurice River than any place I've ever heard of. But anyway, I'm up there, it's raining, it's drizzling, and I knew the guy in the boat had the gun, and I knew the guy in the boat had the bear spray. But so it was one of those things where you just sit there and you think, God, you know, every time I look around, I kept imagining bears, because I bet I said I had a couple friends that have been mauled up there. And so it just puts this sort of itch in your neck. So I started working my way down, and I finally got to the place I wanted to fish, the log jam on the other side, and I hooked this really nice fish. And Joe starts walking up the river, and he goes, you got a fish? And I said, no, I'm stuck on a rock. Of course I got a fish. Well, he didn't hear the fish part. He thought I was stuck on the rock. So the guy asking me, he said, well, what's Jim doing? He said, oh, he's stuck on a rock or a log. And so he put the net back in the boat and starts walking up the beach, you know, like he's kicking a tin can down the beach. And he gets up about three quarters of the way, and he sees I've got, you know, about 80% of all my line off my reel, and I'm losing it fast. Because the farther the fish gets downriver, you have no control
right,
over
it. Right, you're screwed. And so,
and so then the guy gets up there and he goes, you're not stuck, you got a fish. And I said, of course I have a fish. That's what I told Joe. He said, no, Joe told me you were stuck on a rock. And so he comes running up the beach, jumps in the water like a, you know, splashing water everywhere coming out there. And then the fly line just went slack. And I was like, oh, God. So then I walked back up. It took me about 10 minutes to get on the line back of my reel and put a new fly on. Cleared his fly in the same log jam and got hit again. And I pulled out about an 18, 19-pound steelhead. And the guy netted it and took a bunch of pictures and stuff. So I went right back to the log jam, and I threw another fly. And I was mending the fly upstream, trying to get the fly down in the bottom to get in front of the fish. And I got hit again, and I caught another fish, about 11, 12 pounds. And so finally, he took that one out, and the guy took a bunch of pictures. And so I made a cast up, sort of up really, really close to the log jams. And what was happening, the steelhead was just stacked under these logs. Like logs and cut, and they were just stacked one right after another, and I hooked another fish, but this one went upstream, and this was just a huge fish. And the problem is on the Maurice, there's a law that says you can't fish out of a boat on the Maurice River. Okay, you can wade, and then you can use the boat as transportation, but you can't actually fish out of the boat. It drives me absolutely nuts. So I finally hooked this fish, and he goes around the corner, and I lose my leader, my T220, everything, my fly. And I was so mad, and the guy kept going, well, nothing I can do. I said, we're the only people on the damn river. Who in the hell out here is going to even knows we're here? You know? Yeah. I said, all you had to do was run the boat around the corner. And so one thing led to another, and so I put on another fly, and I walked back down there, and he goes, well, why don't you ask your buddy to come up here and let him fish? I'm going, what do you mean? I don't know that guy. I never met him before yesterday.
Oh, you're bad, Jim. You're bad.
He starts giving me a hard time, and I said, I looked at him. I told the guy right to his face. I said, you know, you never get days like this very often. Yeah. Okay. And you're asking me to get up, bring my fly in, put it on the fly rod, and walk down there and let him come up and fish. I said, I will never catch him or steal him. Yeah, I told him, I will never catch another steelhead. I promise you, I am going to be cursed the rest of my life. The gods will come down, and they will never let me catch a fish again.
That's funny.
So he gets up there, guide puts them in the same spot I was in, same fly, same leader. And they start, and Joe's actually a very good tester. And so he's up there, and he's sitting there, and I was just leaning up against the boat, and I was just doing these short roll casts in maybe 10, 12 feet of water. And I hooked another steelhead. And so, you know, they were looking, but they really didn't see what I was doing, so I walked behind the boat, pulled on as tight as I could, got the steelhead out. It was about a 6-7 pound steelhead. Took the fly out. And so I'm going, okay. I cut the fly off, took my reel apart, put the rod in the tube, and I just stopped fishing because I could just imagine what Joe would have said if he had known that I'd went down and stepped in the same damn boat, same place behind the boat he did, and hooked a steelhead.
All right, that is quite a unique experience, that's for sure. Yeah.
The problem is it's all based on the water. It's based on the season. It's based on the anadromous fish that come in, because these fish don't come in every year. Sometimes there's bigger fish. Sometimes there's smaller fish. But like I said, the seasons usually dictate what size of the fish and how many fish are in. But the real sort of demarcation line is how many salmon are coming in. Now, if you have a really low count of salmon, they shut the netting down. If you have, and when they shut that netting down of netting salmon, commercial fishermen, you get lots of steelhead, depending upon if that was going to be a good run anyway. I mean, you could have closed the salmon season down and still had a bad steelhead season, but normally it doesn't work that way. I've talked to a lot of the biologists. They just don't have enough money to get out there and do the counting.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
And so there's always this bycatch. But so, you know, it's just one.
Yes, so really what I'm hearing from you is there's not a whole lot of, you know, fly techniques involved that are, you know, kind of special or tricky or anything. It's more about being in the right place at the right time and then, you know, and then putting that fly in front of the fish. But if those first factors aren't in play, it doesn't matter how good a fisherman you are, you're not going to catch any steelhead. The elements all have to be. All the pieces of the puzzle have to be in play. And
there's more
variables there than fishing for other fish, per se. Yeah.
The first two chapters, actually the first three chapters in the book, talk about exactly that, about, you know, how many fish come in and how many fish don't come in. Was the water level? I mean, believe it or not, I've seen the Buckley. It was so low that I could walk across the Buckley in knee-deep water, and especially right behind a lodge of and the water sometimes is really, really low, but sometimes when the water is really, really low, there's tons and tons of fish. But other times, the water can be, you know, up, and the fish aren't necessarily there. I think what happens when the water level really drops, they look for these channels, and they look for places to hold up until the rains come and the water comes up, and they move up and to the upper Buckley or to the upper Skeena. The same with the Dean and the Babine. I think that certain times of the year, these fish move, and sometimes they don't. But it doesn't necessarily mean that you can't hook them, catch them at any time. You just got to get the fly in front of the fish and get the fly irritated enough to actually bite the fly. Mm-hmm. I mean, in some ways, it's almost like an Atlantic salmon. Atlantic salmon don't necessarily take a fly because it wants to take a fly. It takes a fly because it's pissed off. Something swam in front of him, and he's just pissed off at what came in front of him, and so he'll charge out and get the fly. And it's just one of these things where these fish, you know, everybody says, well, you can't catch steelhead, you can't catch Atlantic salmon in late October and November. Well, you can. It's because the fish aren't really hungry. They don't feed, even though I have seen plenty of steelhead in the upper Buckley and up in the Maurice and actually taking bugs off the top of the water. So, you know, at some point I can't imagine these fish are taking the bugs off the top of the water because they're pissed off at the bugs. I got to tell you, it's just something that's built into their DNA.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
what
they do.
Yeah.
They come up, they feed, and the fish, the way they move up, like the fish that come in early in the spring, they don't move up very fast. Then it's a little later in the spring and the summer, they may move up a little bit faster, but not really, because they're not going to spawn until the following year.
Yeah.
And so they take their time getting up. So by the time you get there in October, November, you get a larger fish, a more hefty fish, a fish that's just bolted up the river from the bottom to the top, and it's ready to go up and spawn. They're just hardier fish. They've got a deeper belly. They're stronger. They're just healthy fish. All the fish are healthy, but there's certain strains. I mean, it's the same with Atlantic salmon. you know, not all Atlantic salmon are created equal.
Well, we got, Jim, we got a question in here from Tom on the internet. It says, have you tried to catch steelhead in Steelhead Alley and Lake Erie from Vermilion, Ohio to Western New York State?
Yeah, my wife and I, after we graduated from Florida State, we moved up to Massachusetts, and my wife was a senior research scientist for Vertex Pharmaceuticals, and I was teaching AP Chemistry and Physics in New Hampshire. And I ran into all the guys, and we fished a lot of places on the Great Lakes, but we fished, God, I can't remember the name of that river. There's so many people on it, I never even fished it. I've tried three or four times. Oh, God, it comes out of one of the big lakes. Jesus Christ. I'll think of it in a minute. But we fished a lot of the tributaries and a lot of the smaller lakes and a lot of the big lakes. We actually fished a lot of the tributaries on the Canadian Shield side, on the other side. And they had a lot of steelhead rivers and stuff that dumped in into the lakes into the United States. Patsky?
Did you find the fishing there harder or easier?
Well, it was
than...
harder because there's so many people. I mean, you're essentially... Oh. The problem is with fishing Massachusetts and fishing New York, actually the places we were staying, sleeping in, and actually fishing, we were fishing the dam and the fly fishing only zone in New York. And Jesus Christ, I'll think of the name of this lake and this river in a minute. But it's not necessarily fish. The fish are relatively still aggressive. It's just there's so many people. It's just insane. I mean, if you like, you were literally, if you wanted to fish, you got to fish shoulder to shoulder to shoulder to shoulder to shoulder all the way down the river. And in the wintertime when the fish are in there, there's so much snow and ice that it's hard to actually fit. I mean, actually, you know, get out there and navigate yourself.
Yeah.
But it's interesting. The fisheries up there were good. Actually, I ended up, this is sort of an offbeat story, but I ended up meeting the father and son, and I was fishing in Rangeley. I was fishing in Lake Elizabeth Lip Dock for landlocked salmon and trout, but there was another, God, what did I say? Elizabeth Lip Dock. Oh, Jesus Christ. I should have wrote all this down before I even tried to pick up the phone. but there's so many lakes and rivers once you get up into Rangeley, it's ridiculous. But that's where Carrie Stevens and her husband had the fish camp on the upper river. And the water, originally that the river goes down in Miss McGlintock and actually goes down even farther than that. It was made for bringing logs down the river. But the people that worked in the off season, they were working as guides to take people fishing. They have an upper dam at that time. They had an upper dam, a middle dam, and a lower dam was still intact, but the lower dam's gone now. But
you kind of lost me here. You said Rangeley. What are we talking? Are we talking about steelhead, or are we talking about?
No, Rangeley was mostly brook trout.
Giant
brook trout.
Yeah. Okay,
but there were landlocked salmon in there. And that's what I was getting at. There's some huge landlocked salmon in there. And a lot of the lakes there. Moose McGlintock, Umbagog, there was a lot of big landlocked salmon. And actually, Maine is probably more famous for landlocked salmon than it is brook trout.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a cool place.
Let's move on to Atlantic salmon, since you brought up salmon. Let's talk about that. What was your first try at Atlantic salmon like?
I went, believe it or not, I have a really close friend. His name is Mark Lance. He just passed away last year. And he had a melanoma on the brain, and he just died out of nowhere. One of the greatest athletes I've ever seen in my life. And we would go up, and there was a place, oh, God, I'm trying to think of the name of that little lodge. It was on the Petite Cascopedia. I can't even remember the name of the lodge, but it was the Petite Cascopedia, the Bonaventure, and about a half dozen other different tributaries and rivers that go up the Gaspé. And essentially, at that time, a lot of the rivers and stuff were still closed to the people that owned the land and on the water. And then you had the Grand Cascopedia Society, had Middle Camp. I fished Middle Camp dozens and dozens of times. And that's just a learning curve. I mean, there's a lot of fish in there, depending upon the time of the year. And if you can get in there in May and June when the water's really cold and the water and the fish are coming up, you stand a really good chance of catching fish. You get into June, July, it starts to peter out unless you just have a really cold summer, which doesn't happen anymore. And what happens is the fish go up and they just stay in some of these big pools, and they're just hard to hook. But first time I went up there, I spent, I think, 9 days trying to catch a salmon and never even saw a salmon. Then I turned around and came back, I guess, about a month and a half later, and I fished a Grand Cascapedia, but it was probably in late June, early July, which was too late, and I never caught a fish. And I was really getting sort of tired of all of this because we were going up there. Actually, what we were doing is Mark was a great photographer, and we would go up and take all the photographs and stuff for lodges and your websites and things like that. So we got to actually stay at a lot of the lodges for nothing, but we got the fish. Mm-hmm. And so I think it was after the third time I was up there, and I still hadn't caught a fish. Mark had caught an 18-pound Atlantic salmon about 5 years before I'd actually went up there. And so we went up there, and we'd stick 6, 7, 8 days. We fished the Matapedia. We fished the upper Matapedia, the salmon. We fished a lot of the rivers in New Brunswick down by Middle Camp, and never caught a fish. And finally, after about 5 weeks of this, on the last day, 50 yards from the pullout, I sitting in the canoe, Mark had already ripped his fly rod apart. I thought he was going to kill the guide. The guy that owns it. He owns Matapedia River Lodge, which is, I have so many stories about that, I don't want to get into it. But he was one of the worst guides on the planet. Still is one of the worst guides on the planet. I was just up there this year. And
still, he hasn't gotten any better.
No, but he weighs about 350 pounds, and he's in a giant Atlantic salmon canoe, and he's either falling asleep or falling out of the canoe, or trying to get up and pole and falling out of the canoe. And so I was just getting frustrated. Mark was taking his rod apart, and he says, "That's it. I'm never coming back." I'm going, "Well, why don't you fish and I'll take my rod apart?" And he goes, "No, get up there." And we were arguing about this, so finally, the guy kept telling me, "Fish left, fish left, fish left," and we had pushed the canoe all the way over to the right-hand side. So I was fishing left, and I saw this big rock and a pool behind the rock, and I said, "What do you think about me throwing a fly over there?" And he goes, No, there's only grouse over there, And I'm going, "Well, I could settle for grouse right about now."
Yeah, yeah.
And we got about 4 or 5 feet from the rock, and I just stripped all my line, and I just lifted the fly rod over. And I had a Kerry Stevens Atlantic salmon fly on, and I just dropped it right behind a rock. It swung, and I got, boom, it's got a really good hit. Then he goes, get it out. It's only a damn grouse. It's only a damn grouse. He's screaming and yelling, the canoe's rocking, and, oh, Jesus Christ. I just wanted to kill him. And so one thing leads to another. Three or four minutes later, this fish is already out in the middle of the river, and he comes up, and it's about a 22, 23-pound Atlantic salmon just shaking his head.
Wow.
And so the problem is it's right in front of a bridge. It has an ice cutter, and the fish is in the middle of the river, and we're in the middle of the river with a canoe. And so we're sort of floating down towards the lodge, and he wanted to go to the shore, fight the fish on the shore, and I'm going, no. He's in the middle of the river. How do you know if he's going to go on the other side of the river or this side of the river? And so we argued, and finally, after about 20, 25 minutes, I was on the beach, and I finally walked the fish up, and I was getting ready to pull him into the net. And then he comes running out with this giant Atlantic salmon net and trips and falls in the water. And the Atlantic salmon just took off like a bat out of hell. And I had to start the whole process over. But I finally caught the fish, and he was about 22, 23 pounds. Gorgeous fish, big hen, and that was my first Atlantic salmon. Well, then it just all sort of started to come together, and so we started fishing the bigger rivers and the better rivers, and even if we had to pay or we had to do something for the lodge, whatever the situation was, we would do it. We actually had maybe a year and a half, 2 years before COVID, we were fishing at Middle Camp, and there were six of us, and we caught 36 salmon, three of them over 30 pounds, and
Is this just very similar then to steelhead, and it's the pieces have to all be together to be in the right place at the right time, and you either have bonanza or nothing at all.
Because we went to British Columbia and we'd actually fished and caught a lot of steelhead. So when we went back, we fished it Grand Cascapedia, and we fished in Middle Camp because that's when we got 36 steelhead, I mean salmon. And then we left, came home, packed our bags, and we went back to British Columbia. On our second trip back to British Columbia, we only caught one fish out of eight of us for 7 days. So then we got back, and we about two or three weeks later, we flew back to Grand Gaspé, and we fished Bonaventure and some of the other rivers that you can fish daily by with a fishing license, like the Grand Cascade, I mean, not the Grand Cascapedia, but the Bonaventure, and you just go down to something called the, oh, I can't remember the name, what they call it, the ZEC. You've got in order to get a fishing license, in order to fish up there, you got to get a fishing license from the Grand Cascapedia Society, which is a museum, which means you're going to cough up tons and tons of money. Or you can go into these sort of gas stations on some of these other rivers, and you can pay $30, $35 for a beat. And so you can go in and fish that beat all day, or go back and get another beat and go back in. And essentially, though, if you're in good water and you've got fish in the river, there's really no reason to move. Maybe just lack of boredom, because I sit there all day just casting, swinging flies over, over fish, and never even got a bump.
How important is a guide up there for fishing Atlantic salmon for putting you in the right place? I mean,
well, if you're fishing like on the Grand Cascapedia, the lodges on the Grand Cascapedia are great. The guides are world class. They're all Mi'kmaq Indians, and they're really, really, really good. There's a couple of Orvis lodges up there too. Haven't been up there since COVID, but it's just something that you've got to tolerate until you catch one or two fish, and then things start to click. But sometimes it does. these fish are. That's the problem. This whole thing with steelhead, Atlantic salmon, and permit. I mean, they're all very difficult fish to catch. You know?
Yeah.
It's not impossible. But if you live where I do in Mobile, Alabama, it gets very expensive. Keep going up to the gas tank. I fish Labrador and Newfoundland for the giant brook trout. I fish Middle Camp for it's called 11 or 12 pound brook trout at Middle Camp. I just spent a lot of time up there flying in and doing floats and stuff with other fishermen because I knew there were a lot of fish in there and I knew the fish would feed and people would have a blast and so they'd go back. But Atlantic salmon and steelhead and permit are just like, it really is the holy grail of fly fishing.
Yeah.
But you've got to have.
Hang on to that thought here, Jim, for a second. I got to take a quick break, and then we'll come back, and we'll finish up with Atlantic salmon, and we still got to talk about permits, so hang tight. I'll be right back. Discover the power of pure Skagit with Olympic Peninsula Skagit Tactics. From delicate soft hackles to hefty steelhead flies, OPST's versatile casting system meets the demands of every angling situation. With Ed Ward's unparalleled Skagit rod design and casting expertise, OPST offers you a quicker route to mastering effective casting techniques. Whether battling wind and rain or targeting steelhead trout or smallmouth bass, trust OPST's innovative rods, lines, and tips elevate your fishing experience. Join the ranks of skilled anglers who rely on OPST for consistency, proficiency, and a superior fly fishing adventure. Unleash your potential with OPST today. Visit PureSkagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. Again, that's PureSkagit.com or call them at 206-858-8476. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio, and we're talking with Jim Stinson about A Tale of Three Fish. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our hand page at AskAboutFlyFishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. Okay, so back at the salmon here, Jim. When you go up there to fish for salmon, are you going with whatever the guides are giving you for flies and so forth, or do you research that ahead of time and come up with your own selection? How do you handle that?
You ever seen a big fly box and a big fly shop, where you raise up the cabinet and you've got tens of thousands of flies in there to choose from?
Yep.
It's in my bedroom.
That's in your bedroom? Okay. And your wife sleeps down the hall, right?
No, I have two rooms. You know these racks that you put in shops, you know, these aluminum racks where you stack all these plastic boxes? Well, I have two rooms that are just absolutely stuffed. Probably 75 to 80 stay rods, maybe 25 or 30 conventional rods left. I've still got tons and tons of. I have got reels going back to when I was 11, 12 years old, 10 704s, 713s, all this stuff, and it's all brand new. I mean, it's because I take care of it. But when I first started, I thought tying flies was going to be the coolest thing in the world. After 6 months, I thought buying flies were the coolest thing in the world. Because it's time consuming. And you know, everybody, you know, there's so many great fly tires out there. And I've got a lot of companies that I work with that give me flies. I mean, when they come up with a new salmon flies and stuff. I still have, how should I put this? You have people out there that will stand in a river all day and throw red and white woolly buggers or purple woolly buggers, and that's it. And that's all they do is swing woolly buggers, black and gold, blue, all these different colors, and they swing them. They hand out, and they catch fish. Well, just as many fish as anybody else does. Yet I know when I go fishing, I take sometimes 150, 200 flies. I've got them in these boxes. I just wrap them in a rubber band. And I always drive up. I don't fly up. And my wife thinks that's the craziest thing in the world. But I've driven in Labrador, Newfoundland, Nova Scotia. And I love it up there. It's a long drive, but I pick up my customers along the way, and we stay at hotels, and we drink and eat and food. We have a great time when we go up. But you got to have time to do that. And I have a really understanding wife, either that or she's having an affair with somebody. But it's really, truly one of these things where I am in awe of people that like to tie flies. Okay, I just don't have the patience. There's just too many things going on in my life to sit there and tie flies. Even though I have a big table with vices loaded on it and everything else, and about, I don't know, 30, 40 fly tying books. But it's just...
So do you, you've obviously got a huge selection of flies, and when you go up to there to fish for Atlantic salmon, you mentioned some guys fishing woolly buggers all day long. How often are you switching up your flies to different styles?
Well, the guys with the woolly buggers are usually steelhead fishermen, and they're from Idaho, Oregon, Washington, and maybe low to British Columbia. They're just older guys that have been, that's all they want to do.
Over there, yeah.
These flies, these new steelhead flies, you know, they're really great, and they're multitudes of colors and sizes, and... Yeah, fishing with steelhead on the West Coast is totally different than fishing on the East Coast. But that's what they do, because they believe there's no reason in the world to put on another fly when this one works perfectly well. They believe that the trick to catching a steelhead is being able to cast a fly, or if you're using a spay rod, use the spay rod out there, have the fly, make it swing, and make the fly do what it needs to do in the water. I mean, you know, you can bend up, you can bend down. You can put more weight on there, depending on the size of head you want on your stay line. You know, there's just places in British Columbia I use 25 feet of T20. I'm convinced with a lot of people that don't catch fish on these big rivers in the wintertime is because they just will not use a real heavy T20 line to get the fly down. And so, but the water's high and the water's running fast, and so you're mending its way in any direction you want to.
So back to the Atlantic salmon, because we were talking about Atlantic salmon. How often are you changing your flies there? You know what?
Well, what we do is when we're in a Atlantic salmon canoe, and the guy's obviously down front, the canoe's turned backwards, and we're lifting the anchor up and going down maybe 2 feet at a time, 2 feet at a time. So we swing from the back to the front, the back to the front, the back to the front on both sides. And then once we get down to the end of the pool, we take another fly off, and we change the flies. Sometimes we use bombers. Sometimes we use sinking flies. But we keep going back and forth to the top of the pool, top of the pool, top of the pool, because we know more often than not that water's deep enough to hold fish. And what happens is, depending upon the time of the year, if it's really cold, the fish will move up, and they love that cold water. But once it starts to get the end of May, early June, even into July, these fish hunker down in these big pools, waiting for the water to come up and cool down so they can move up in the fall and spawn. But it's, you know... my wife thinks I'm freaking crazy. When we go fishing and we're in this Atlantic salmon canoe, we usually have three, four boxes opened up of maybe 150, 200 flies arguing with each other which one's the best fly. And in reality, we just keep changing flies.
Yeah.
But, you know.
Is there two of you fishing out of a canoe?
No. Sometimes there are, but most of the time we fish one out of a canoe and the guide.
Oh, one out of a canoe. Okay. Okay.
We can fish two out of the canoe, but if you fish two out of a canoe, depending upon, you know, what the financial deal is, but if you fish two out of a canoe, then one guy fishes down, then you take the canoe back up, and the next guy fishes
down.
Oh,
okay. So you're losing 50%
of the time. Yeah, you're losing 50% of the time on the water.
Right. Okay.
And like on the Matapedia, I know dozens of guys that work for some of the camps up and down the river that are really, really good. And a lot of times if they don't have customers or they're not booked that day, they just call us and pick us up and take us up river. And they leave the canoes on the rivers at night. And so they don't have to do the shuttles every day. So they run down and then they come back and tie the canoe off to a tree. And the next day they come back in and hop in and use the canoe. Each river up there has its own little unique thing. Some are really wide, really fast. The Bonaventure is one of the clearest rivers in the world. It's almost impossible to sneak up on a good fish. But they catch them. I mean, it's just steelhead. I'll carry 2 or 3 flies in a box when I'm steelhead fishing because I like to use purple and black. And more often than not, sometimes I use red and black or red and orange. There's certain colors I like. And it doesn't mean that you couldn't catch a steelhead on any other color. It just means that I'm like these guys with the woolly booger. When I catch fish on them, there's no reason to change. Mm-hmm. But the Atlantic salmon, it's just a totally different fish. I mean, they move up these, like I said, they move up these rivers. They're not there to feed. I mean, if something swings in front of them, more often than not, they're hitting that fly out of anger.
Right.
But that's just the nature of the game.
I've
never really seen a big Atlantic salmon take a bait. I've seen them whack flies, but I don't think they were whacking flies because they were hungry. I think they were whacking flies just to get it out of the front of their face.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a learning curve too. I don't even know how to express that. It just takes time.
Yeah. Let's take another quick break and when we come back, let's talk about permit because that's the third one in the Holy Trinity for you. So hang tight. We'll be right back. Fly Fishers International needs your support. Its conservation projects at both the national and club level are addressing critical issues of importance to fly fishers. The organization provides grants to help with the restoration of habitats like the Wolf Creek in Idaho and Sands Creek in Delaware County, New York, and funds projects that collect valuable data about fish and their habitats like peacock bass study in Miami, Florida. FFI serves as a strong advocate for fly fishing in all waters for all fish to preserve and promote the arts of fly casting and fly tying and to help ensure future generations can continue to enjoy these one-of-a-kind experiences. These efforts won't be nearly as effective without your help. If you're not already a member, we invite you to join Fly Fishers International as they work to cultivate conservation, education, and community within the sport of fly fishing. Join Fly Fishers International today and help support their fine work. For more information, go to their website at flyfishersinternational.org. That's flyfishersinternational.org. You're listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We're talking with Jim Stenson about A Tale of Three Fish. If you'd like to ask Jim a question, just go to our homepage at askaboutflyfishing.com and use that Q&A text box to send us your question. So, Jim, let's switch on to number 3.
Have you got one of my books in front of you?
Yep. Got it right here.
Okay. Go to page 82.
82. Okay.
This will sum up everything. Third paragraph.
Okay. 82.
I remember with almost perfect clarity the spiritual awakening, the epiphany, the moment I finally realized how ridiculous it was to think that I could hoodwink a permit with a twisted piece of steel, 2 lead eyes wrapped in fluorescent green carpet, and a few pieces of 1960s shag carpet. Suddenly it occurred to me that I was chasing what's considered to be the spookiest fish in the ocean, a fish with the personality of a paranoid schizophrenic, unraveled vision, nostrils the size of a large slushy straw, and somehow I expected at least one of them to swim over and slurp up my fly as if it was just another crab crawling along the bottom. In sober consideration, such expectations borders on dementia. a break from reality, a condition caused by too many days in the hot sun, glaring into the abyss. Then again, if I was particularly prone to sober consideration, I wouldn't be trying to catch anything on a damn fly to begin with.
Yeah, that does kind of sum it up, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
Okay, show's over. Show's over.
I have some friends that are guides down in the Yucatan, and mm-hmm. I have friends that are guides and stuff down in even south of there, almost into, Dangria. And one of them's And him and I have been chasing permit for, I don't know, 35 years. And I have more permit stories. Everybody has their own permit stories. But when I go, I fish out of the boat with him while the other customers are fishing for permit and bonefish. But we have it so staked out where it depends upon the weather. I mean, that's a big deal down there because the weather and the water coming over to the rocks and the mangroves and stuff. There's a lot of environmental things attached to this, to getting a permit to actually hit something. But I would be willing to guess that I have thrown 1,500 flies, 2,000 flies at permit. Mm-hmm. I've had them swim to the boat, follow my fly to the boat, and turn around and bolt. I picked up a fly and dropped it over his head again, swam back to the boat. I could have picked him up by the tail. He swiped at the fly, swam off. I've had so many permit chase my fly, and there's so many ideas about how to catch a permit. They're telling you now to drop a fly on top of a permit's head because he spooks and thinks it's a crab. But I'm telling you, that rarely works. It usually scares the shit out of the crab.
Yeah,
the permit,
yeah.
He's bolted off the flat.
That's
but
my experience.
If you can get a school of permit, say 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 fish in a school, that's a whole different story because then they get aggressive and they're always competitive. And I've thrown flies at 30, 35-pound permit all day long and never had one pick one up. I know there's just been occasions when, you know, we have 6, 7, maybe 8 dozen live crabs in the back of the boat. If I get frustrated, I just put a live crab on and pitch it out there, and I can miss the fish by 50 feet, and he'll swim over and eat the damn crab. I mean, it gets to the point where I am going to catch a permit. Okay. There's no law in any book anywhere that says I am restricted to a fly rod. And
where did you catch your first permit on a fly rod? Was it in Florida or was it somewhere else?
Yeah, it was in Florida. It was off the beach. Believe it or not, when we were growing up, from Palm Beach to actually the end of Fort Lauderdale down to Dania, all the beaches were open. There was no condos. You couldn't find a condo on the beach. And so we'd look over the piers and we'd see schools of the big bonefish and schools of permit coming down to maybe in a foot and a half of water. And so we would run down to the beaches and chase these fish and start throwing flies at them. And that's sort of how we got sort of inundated into this, or I should say, you know, it's how we learned to do it. But Lake Worth Pier, what makes Lake Worth Pier so great is it is the closest pier to the Gulf Stream in Florida. Actually, it's the closest pier to the Gulf Stream anywhere on the eastern coast. And the water comes by, and there's 2 or 3 giant reefs in front of the pier, and the water comes in. And I bet you in total over the years we probably caught 50, 60 sailfish, and dozens of them were records. We caught permit. And some of them on the beach and some of them not on the beach. Sometimes we'd throw big crabs at them on the pier. We were kids. We were 13, 14, 15, 16 years old. And you'd get into the pier itself and what we call where you go in and you pay and you pick up the shrimp and whatever you want to buy. But there was dozens and dozens of permit and sailfish on the wall, all of them IGFA records.
Not anymore, I bet, right?
No. Everything's just grown and so developed.
Yeah,
the beaches, the condos everywhere. It's
yeah.
The problem is the only pier really worth fishing anymore out of off the east coast of Florida is probably Dania. Dania's still got a really good pier. It's a fishing pier. Well, they've torn down all the other piers. And Anglin's Pier, Pompano, Deerfield, and even though Lake Worth is still standing, the T's been gone because the money that was set aside to rebuild these piers has been used to build piers for tourists. Now the piers are three times higher than they were. They're 10 times wider. And you walk out there and there's just thousands of people on the pier.
Yeah.
And the last thing you want to do is be out there with a fly rod or a big spinning rod.
But, where do you where do you fish for permit now?
I fish the Abacos a lot. I fish Easton Lodge a lot. I was actually also, I had the marketing agreement for Deepwater K-Bar T and High Lonesome Ranch for about 7 years before the hurricane wiped out Deepwater K. And so I fish a lot of the places out there. And the problem is, I would say about 30% of all of the lodges that was built 8, 9, 10 years ago are gone because the people kept, you know, they kept getting crushed by these storms and their insurance kept going up and up and up and they couldn't afford to pay the insurance. So, but the Keys at one time, I mean, when I was growing up, we would go down to the Keys at 7 Mile Bridge and we'd spend 3, 4 days at a time down there chasing permits. And it was just incredible. But everything was cheap. I mean, you could afford, I hate to admit this, but we used to take $2, $3, $4, $5 a piece, put it in a pool, and we would go into the African-American neighborhoods, and we would buy their food stamps from them, and they would take our dollars, and we would go to Publix, and we would use the food stamps to buy the food so we could camp on the beaches in the Keys.
Oh, geez.
But it was, I mean, that's what growing up with kids are like. I mean, but, I mean, everything that I know about fishing, every place I fish, they're all the people I know about fishing. Because I started young. And I'd say 90% of the people I grew up with are still alive. And they're still fishing.
Yeah.
So,
well, you said you fished for permit quite a bit in Belize, right? Did you find that as productive as,
Yeah, Belize is kind of a funky place. Because the water there is, you wouldn't think the permit would run right along the reef itself. I mean, really, really close. I've been in Belize, down on my hands and knees, pouring down rain, wind blowing, and school of permit 10, 15 feet in front of me, and I drop a fly right in the middle of it, and they just split. They make a dig and go away. They don't even look at it.
You've been up to Windward Key? You know where Windward Key is? It's a little bit north. But last time my son and I fished there, it was just like you said, we're right on where the reef's breaking, and the permit to come through that, through the little passes from the deep, come through that, grab some crabs, and go back out through that. I mean, you're right on the reef. I mean, literally,
I like to fish Playa Blanca and Casablanca, but it's got so expensive and so many people want to go down there. And plus, the real problem with permit fishing is, for some reason, people aren't concerned about going down when the permit fishing is at its best. What you're concerned about is going down when it's not as hot. Okay. So you get down there, and the problem is, in reality, permits spawn in March, April, and May. Okay. Yet people consider that to be the best permit fishing season. The longer, the hotter it gets into the summer, the more permits show up because they've already spawned. They spawn in 60, 70, 80 feet of water. They're also nocturnal. And if you've got a full moon and you booked a trip in 3 out of 4 days or 4 out of 5 days, you've got a full moon at night, these fish are going to come up and they're going to feed all night long and then they're going to go offshore and sulk. The same with bonefish. Bonefish are nocturnal. Snook are nocturnal. Tarpon are nocturnal. And it's what they do. If you don't get the right tides at the right season and the right dates, you're not going to do as well as somebody that's willing to sit out there in the middle of June, July, and August, and pound the water for permit.
Yeah, yeah. And what I found with the permit, it was like, you know, having a good guide is everything when you're fishing for permit.
Oh, God, yes.
If you don't have a person a guide that can put you in the right place, position the boat and the wind, and find the permit, and
there's a lot of
opportunity, you know, it's... That's much different than, you know, like Atlantic salmon or steelhead, right? I mean, because everything's in motion, you know.
When I was growing up, the best bone fishing and the best permit fishing on the planet was Biscayne Bay in the middle of the summer. It was hot as hell. The mangoes were everywhere, and it's essentially it was north of Key Largo. And actually, Cartown Road and all that places in the north of Key Largo, Biscayne, Severn Biscayne Bay, it was full of mangroves, even though all the development around them just never seemed to bother the fish. But that was, if you wanted to catch a permit, a nice fish, June, July, and August on a new moon was probably as good as it gets. And, you know, that's, you guys make your money doing that.
Do you have a particular unique experience with permit that you'd like to share? Particular place, conditions?
Well, more often than not, I've lost almost every permit. I've caught probably, I don't know, maybe 110, 115 permit on live crabs, and I've caught 23 permit on a fly.
The fly, yeah.
Yeah. But I think the problem is, if I had my choice, and that's the real problem here, you know, where do you want to go fish, what kind of fish you want to catch, and then you're looking at the customers you take, and then the first question out of your mouth is, well, have you ever been permit fishing, have you ever been Atlantic salmon fishing, have you ever tried to chase steelhead? And a lot of them will say no. And it really bugs me, because I know that if somebody goes and fishes for Atlantic salmon and we're having a slow week, and they're probably not going to catch any fish, mainly because they really don't know what they're doing yet. It's a learning curve. But they get so pissed off, they don't want to come back. Because they're convinced it's my fault that they didn't catch a permit. I mean, they didn't catch an Atlantic salmon. And it's my fault because they didn't catch a permit. You know, that's why steelhead fishing in the wintertime up in British Columbia and Oregon and Washington is great, because there usually are a lot of fish caught. But,
Well, that was my question. My question earlier in the evening was, you know, what kind of expectations do you set? And that's a big part of all three of these fish, right?
You need to
educate yourself on that. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, the real point to even say this, and somebody's probably going to shoot me after I say this, but the problem is most people are married. They have two kids, three kids. They have two cars. They have a house, a mortgage. They're probably a doctor or attorney. And they spent their whole life doing the stuff that they need to do for their family and kids and get them into college, get them paid off. And eventually they retire. And then when they retire, sometimes they're in their 50s, 55, 60, 65 years old. And then they turn around and they want to be the guy on the front of the Orvis catalog. And really, truly it is. But they just, you know, God bless them. You know, they did everything right. And then if you look at me, you know, I probably did everything wrong because I wanted to fish. And, but, you know, I still went to school. I still went to grad school and stuff. And, you know, I've done pretty well. But I know deep down inside that, you know, if I had the opportunity, I prefer to fish with people that I know that have at least caught or hooked or have done this before. You can do everything. Like when I lived in Massachusetts, we fished the striper runs, you know, for about three months at a time. Then we would go down to Cape Cod, we'd fish there, we'd actually go down even farther and chase the stripers there. But we were catching huge stripers, we were catching bluefish, and it was just easy. You know, we'd get out there in our waders and we'd get out in the surf and we'd throw flies. It was a piece of cake. People loved it. And that, I think, trying to convince people that that's where they should start, where something,
easier.
They can learn to cast, they can learn to catch.
I can tell you this, that luck does have something to do with it. The first time I took my son tarpon fishing was off Key West. First day we go out, he hooks up two tarpon and he lands about 120-pound tarpon. First time out, he knows nothing about fishing for tarpon, never read a book, never studied, never anything. He does that. I take him to Belize. It wasn't the first day out, but the first week, and I still consider this like really good. The first week we were out, he got his first permit. And I'm going, I don't know how long I've spent trying to get this permit. And he goes up and he's like that though. Everywhere I take him, he's always catching something, you know, and without any education or, you know, I mean, there's luck involved.
I have a friend, his name's Steve Kantner. He has Parkinson's disease right now. And
I know Steve.
We grew up together. And all you can call him and he'll tell you the same stories I'm telling you now. But his wife, she just had heart surgery, and I guess she's back home. I haven't talked to him in like 4 or 5 days. I didn't want to call him. But Steve, and before he had Parkinson's, is one of the best fishermen on the planet. I mean, bar none. I mean, it didn't matter if he was, you know, offshore fishing up the piers or he was back in the Everglades taking people fishing in his canoes. I mean, it was great. He still is. He's still, his intelligence is still there, which is really good. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's as articulate as anybody I've ever met. And, you know, it's sort of sad. I have another friend that came down. He had Parkinson's, then he came down with Alzheimer's on top of it. And his, I don't know if you know Norm Ziegler.
Yes. Yeah. I've interviewed Norm on the show here. Yeah.
Yeah. I've known Norm for 35, 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
And he came down. He just passed away this year. Matter of fact, you're going to
I didn't even know that.
Yeah.
Oh, boy.
Yeah, I remember walking into the shop on Sanibel, and I hadn't been down there for 2 or 3 weeks. And he started talking, but his speech was slurred. And you never knew about Norm because he had Lyme disease on top of everything.
Oh, my goodness.
And so he was sort of shuffling around, and he was, you know, his voice was really sort of slurred. And I said, Norm, man, you need to go to the doctor and see what's wrong. He goes, oh, there's nothing wrong with me. Oh, I'm going to Norm, you need to go to the doctor. And eventually, and this is right in the middle of COVID, which made it even worse because nobody could go to him. Mm-hmm. He would have to take these, you know, these remote Zooms from
right.
He loved the Mayo Clinic, so he was always Zooming back and forth from the people at the Mayo Clinic. But they couldn't really do anything except guess.
Mm-hmm.
And after COVID sort of ended up and people started going back to work and people started going to hospitals and doctors, he went and it eventually killed him. And he spent, I guess, about 2.5 years in the hospital.
Oh,
and they finally took him home so he could die at home. And I just talked to Libby today. And it's a sad state of affairs.
Yeah.
He's such
a
nice guy.
Yeah, he was. Yes, he was. We're running out of time here. Jim, question for you. Of all the years, over all the years that, you know, you fished for these three fish, you know, steelhead, Atlantic salmon, and permit, which one has caused you the most amount of consternation?
all of the above? No. Well, yeah, it's really difficult because they're all different. When I fish for permit, I love being out on a flat and flip-flops and shorts.
Yeah.
You know, and
I hear you.
Fishing all day until the sun goes down, then go back and have a few drinks at the bar and the cocktails and get up the next morning and do it again. But at least when I'm doing it, I see fish. Okay. So as long as I see fish, even if I don't catch them or hook them, you know, I feel pretty good. Atlantic salmon, their numbers are down by, I don't know, maybe 75-80%. The native people in Canada, they're netting the fish at the mouth of the Restigouche, which is absolutely sad. They're starting to net the fish on the Cascapedia. And, I mean, we're talking, the fish have been in decline for probably 30, 35, 40 years. And
mm-hmm.
they're getting, and it's getting worse and worse and worse. And yet, you know, they really don't do anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
They talk about it, but they don't do anything about it. But then, like I said before, the stupid government introduced all the striped bass in these rivers. And even these fish that get up and spawn now, the fry are not going to have an opportunity to go back to the ocean and spawn. You're going to all get kneed up by the striped bass. And the Atlantic salmon, I mean, not the Atlantic salmon, but the steelhead, I am really in touch with a lot of people at Sage and Chris Anderson and some other people and some of the guides in Oregon and stuff. And it's got so bad that, you know, a lot of these guys that I know, especially the husband and wife teams, they are sort of giving up on guiding for steelhead, which is a
mm-hmm.
sad state of affairs.
Yeah,
I just think that we're losing stuff at such a rate, especially with the overdevelopment and population growth and pollution. And it's like the Mississippi River, you know, all the damn stuff that comes down the Mississippi River. We have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico about the size of New Jersey. Okay, we're losing all the grass and we're losing all the trees and vegetation in New Orleans. It's a massive onslaught of everything. It's sort of overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
And,
yeah.
But all kinds aside, if I couldn't fish for anything else in the world, I'd probably chase permit.
permit. That was going to be my my next question was, which fish do you dream about catching the most? So you just answered it.
Tarpon and bonefish too.
Yeah.
I just like fly fishing. And when I was growing up, the beaches in Fort Lauderdale and the beaches over in Sarasota, down in Sanibel, in Captiva, Boca Grande, we used to have giant schools of jack, 20, 25-pound jacks come through, and we'd throw flies at them. Mm-hmm. And it knocked your socks off. They were so strong. And they were so aggressive, they were a blast. And everybody says, well, why do you want to fish for jacks? I said, because it's fun, for Christ's sake.
I
think
fun.
We also, we've lost a lot of the fun out of fishing. It's not that it's, people still aren't fishing, it's people fishing all over the place. But when I was growing up, and I keep saying, I shouldn't say when I keep growing up, but I do believe that people are frustrated and they don't know what to do. And, you know, it's like Okeechobee, the Corps of Engineers. I mean, they when they dredged the St. Lucie Canal on the other side and Coosahatchee the other, and they dumped all the damn pollution from the citrus industry, the cattle industry, and the phosphate industries in Okeechobee. You got the algae blooms, the phosphates, all this stuff coming down. Then they open up the dams and dikes, and it flows into the Charlotte Harbor on the west coast, and it flows into St. Lucie on the east coast, and everything is polluted. All the grass is gone.
Well, I think, I think what we can agree on is that fishing will never be as good as when we were kids. I know that's the case for me as well. You grew up in Florida. I grew up in Alaska, and, you know, it was my dad and I would be the only two on a mile of stream, and now it's shoulder to shoulder up there, you know, so.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't blame anybody. I don't blame anybody for this because it's not their fault.
Too many people, not enough water. That's my.
Yeah, and I don't have any answers. That's a question. I don't have the answers. I know what I'd like to say, and I know what I'd like to be able to convince the Corps of Engineers and some of the federal agencies to do, but I have no control over these people.
Well, time to wrap things up, Jim. It's been fun. Hang tight with me. We're going to give away a copy of your book here in just a minute, so. I want you to hang with me till the bitter end here. So,
tell them they should all buy all my books.
All right. Well, hang tight. The Bonefish and Tarpon Trust works very hard to safeguard the future of our beloved flats fisheries, from protecting spawning sites threatened by unsustainable fishing pressure to securing historic funding to restore Florida's Everglades and estuaries. Thanks to their members, they've expanded their conservation to the Bahamas, Belize, and Mexico. There's still much more work to be done, and they need your help. With your support, they can ensure that the flats fishery is healthy and sustainable now and for generations to come. Visit btt.org and become a member of the Bonefish and Tarpon Trust today. Again, that's btt.org. Just a reminder for everyone, before you leave our website tonight, please take a minute and give us feedback about the show. You can find a link on our homepage in the section under tonight's show. This is, what'd you think of the show? Just click on that link. Leave your comments. We'd really appreciate it. So now it's time to give away some prizes. The winners for our drawings are randomly selected from the show's registration database. If you didn't register for tonight's show, it's too late now, but make sure you do so for our next show so you don't miss out on a chance at some of these great prizes. If you are the one lucky winners, we'll contact you after the show and collect your information so that we can deliver your prize to you. So first up is a one-year membership to Fly Fishers International. And to learn more about FFI, go to flyfishersinternational.org, flyfishersinternational.org. Great organization to support. They cover everything from freshwater, warm water, salt water, and worldwide. So check them out if you're not familiar with them. And our winner for that is Brent Satterfield. Brent Satterfield in New Jersey. So Brent Satterfield, you are now... going to be a member of Fly Fishers International. And the second drawing is Trout Unlimited. So learn more about Trout Unlimited, go to TU.org, TU.org, another great organization to support. I love both these organizations because they help with what Jim was just talking about, you know, trying to protect and preserve the waters that we like to fish. The winner for this is Bob Nunn in New Jersey. Bob Nunn in New Jersey. So you have a membership to TU now, Trout Unlimited. So congratulations. So now we'll give away a copy of Jim Stenson's book, A Tale of Three Fish. And the way we do this is I'm going to ask a question, and then you fill out the answer on our homepage in that same area where you can ask a question during the show. Submit that. First person gets it right, and we'll win a copy of Jim's book, A Tale of Three Fish. Now, that's from Stackpole Books. Stackpole Books is one of the greatest publishers of fly fishing books out there. So if you haven't gone to their site and visited, please do so. Also, we have links to Jim's books, A Tale of Three Fish, on the right side of our homepage. Also, his other book, South Florida's Fishing Paradise, which is the last interview I had with Jim. Did a great interview there. So that's another way you can buy the books if you don't win. And let's see here. I'm going to make it super easy tonight just because I feel like it. And what fish out of the three does Jim dream about at night? What fish does he dream about at night? So now that's easy because that's right at the end of the show. I couldn't make it any easier than that. And so now, Jim, we have to just wait a second till they number one hear it because there's a slight pause in the broadcast, and then they have to type. They don't have to type much, but they do have to type. If they're good fly tires, they're probably good typists. I don't know. I don't know if that goes together or not, but anyway, let's see here. And we've got, let's see, it looks like L. Ryan, Tom Zimna says permit, and you got that right, Tom. You couldn't get it wrong. I don't see how, but I don't know where El Raya is, Tom, so you'll have to enlighten me. I'd be curious as to where you live. Anyway, we'll send me your address in that same form that you filled out on the homepage. Send me that over and your shipping address. I've got your name. I got your email address. And then we'll get Stackpole to send out A Tale of Three Fish, courtesy of Stackpole and Jim Stenson. So I know you'll love it. Great read and enjoy. Jim, thanks again so much for being on my show. I really appreciate it. It's always lots of fun to talk to you. And I hope we'll speak again sometime in the future.
Oh, absolutely. I have another book coming out about the end of the year called Hearing About
the Fly. There we go. always a reason to have another interview is to read another book. So, yeah, good. Good to know. We'll talk. You keep in touch. And thanks so much for being on my show. Yeah.
Oh, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Hopefully, everybody has found our archive, our podcast archive on our website. If you haven't, just go to the top line menu on our page. And right there, you'll see podcast archive. And then you can search the archive by keywords and or different categories and so forth there. We hit 400 shows last time. And so it's quite a bit of education you can get on fly fishing and ask about fly fishing. So check that out. And our next show will be June 19th, 7 p.m. Mountain, 9 p.m. Eastern Time. On that show, I'm going to interview Captain Gary Dubiel, and our topic for the show will be fly fishing for trophy redfish. And this Gary has been guiding the North Carolina waters for over 20 years. He is renowned for his expertise in light tackle and fly fishing. In his home waters, catching redfish up to 50 inches is not unusual. So join us to learn Gary's secrets to locating and hooking up these trophy redfish. And on our homepage there, you should find it's not there, so never mind. Add it to your calendar. I'd like to thank Fly Fishers International, Trout Unlimited, Stackpole Books, OPST, and Ugly Bug Fly Shop, and Rico Pugliese Flies for sponsoring our show tonight. Don't forget to visit our website at askaboutflyfishing.com and make sure you receive our announcements so you don't miss out on any of our future broadcasts. Thanks for listening to Ask About Fly Fishing Internet Radio. We hope you enjoyed the show. That's it. Good night, everyone, and good fishing.